Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
Good morning again, everybody. Good to see you. One thing to start, because this is something that we've been kind of leaning into as a church, as a community. If you ever have a moment or you feel like this place, whether it's your very first Sunday or you've been coming here for a number of weeks and you're like, I don't know that I belong here or I fit here. Like, is this the church for me? I can't answer that question for you, but here's what I can say. I feel that way sometimes. And I've been here from the beginning. Like, I've been here the whole time. And there's times where I'm like, do I belong here? Do I fit here? It's not a you question. It's an us question. We all feel that sometimes. And there's greater amount of studies and research showing that we feel more disconnected now than we have in decades. If you feel disconnected, you're not alone. And we're gonna talk about, we're gonna do some things in service where we can kind of help connect with people and connect with the people around you in a way that we hope, like, we kind of provide some structure to it. So it's not just like, go talk to people, but with some questions. But this is the biggest thing I want you to hear. You're not alone in feeling alone. Many of us do. And I think community and what we're trying to do here is it's the antidote to that. It's the answer to that as we continue kind of leaning into that discomfort and also addressing the lies that we hear in our head that convince us we're the only ones that feel alone. We're the only ones that have this experience. You're not alone. You're not alone. It's some of the good news of the gospel. All right. Let's get into our message series in Isaiah. To start, we're going to do a little word association, or words association. I'm going to say a couple, all right? So I want you to prepare yourself. Sometimes there's rhetorical questions. This is not one of them. This is like a yell out, and we're going to hear what we all think, okay? So I'm going to say these words, and then I want you just to capture the first thought that comes into your head. And based on the appropriateness of said thought, I want you to yell it out loud, okay? You ready? Everybody ready? We're doing this together. Parent-teacher conferences. Boring. What else? Keep going. Awful. Love that. Fan? Fail? Failure? Death? I like them. Gold star. I love it. Good. Anything else? I love that death and failure were some of the first words I heard. Out of school early. Yeah, or no school for some people. Bribing. Ooh, that's good. Yeah. I got to go to my son's parent-teacher conference this week. And it was weird because it wasn't my parent-teacher conference. Like, we weren't going to talk about me. And the vast majority of data from my life is that's my experience. I've sat there and we're talking about me. And what was interesting is I thought, oh, well, I'll be fine. But no, we're talking about my son. Like, I really, really, really want to hear all the amazing things, because if my teacher's experience with my son is amazing, we could pretty easily conclude that I am Father of the Year material. It's probably something I'm doing, if we're honest. Why are parents so invested in their kids' success? Successful kids reflect well on parents. And so what was interesting was I had this, I was falling into this trap that if my son was successful, I would be successful too. And I was in this place where we were going to talk about performance and we're going to talk about things. And what it also triggered for me is all my past experiences. When I went to parent-teacher conferences, here's the thing. It's a good thing I'm a pastor of this church now at 36 and not 8. You would have hated 8-year-old Kurt. I was a little turd. I was. And I would go into classes, and I wasn't interested in learning. That wasn't why I was there. I was interested to see how close I could get to the line of getting thrown out of the class, but never get thrown out of the class. Do you know this? Like, I would like get a read for how's my teacher doing today? And like, she can handle a couple poop jokes. I'm going to do those because my classmates are going to love them. This material slays. And then we had the check system. I don't know if you had this. First infraction, name on the board. Second infraction, check. You know, first infraction, no, that would be second. Third infraction, check. You get three checks, that's a big deal. You lose recess. I enjoyed entertaining others and myself. I wasn't a fool. I wasn't going to miss out on recess, right? I was the king of my name and two checks, except for Tuesdays, because my mom was a volunteer who came in to teach Project Self-Esteem. And guess what? Kurt never got his name on the board those days. I was not about to be exposed. But parent-teacher conferences shattered that wall and that illusion. Now was the place where I could be exposed and like everyone can know who I am and what I am. And I was terrified in that place of hearing anything about me that wasn't positive and wasn't affirming. Why? Because I was sure that any indictment of my behavior was ultimately an indictment of me. It would expose who I was in that space. And maybe for you, that was parent-teacher conferences. Maybe you were the kid, which is good. Like, my story isn't the good story. They just are. You might have been the kid that were so excited for parent-teacher conferences because you're like, now my parents are going to get to see me. Now they're going to know from another person, like, how much I am awesome in this class and in this space. And there's going to be this affirmation and affirming of who I am and how I am as a child and a student. And that's great. But the environment was such that we set into it and our identity is on the line in some way. Some aspect of our identity is on the line. And I think those feelings and experiences are really helpful to identify going into Isaiah. So Isaiah is a big, big book in the Old Testament, 66 chapters. But a lot of it, it's a prophecy. Isaiah, it's named after the prophet Isaiah. And the prophet, we've talked about this, prophets step forward and they're the person on the Titanic that's saying, there's an iceberg, and if we don't change course, we're going to run into it. It's right out there. A lot of times when we hear prophets of the Bible, we think of like the person that's, you know, has camel teeth woven into their beard and they come in from the desert to say like these insane prophecies that all turn out to be true. They're actually a person that is deeply embedded within the culture and the system and the society, and they are the ones that God has lifted up to say and speak into. Do you all see where this is taking us? Do you all see where this is taking us right now? And what's really interesting about that is when we understand that as prophets and we put that in, oh, there are people within our societies, within our communities that see things that not everybody sees, and they're unafraid to speak it and say, this is where this is heading for us. When we have that framework, now we are better equipped to see and listen to our prophets today, because prophets didn't go away in the Bible. They're around today in our world, in our culture. There are prophets in Portland saying, if we continue to have skyrocketing housing prices and we keep on pushing people out through higher rents, we're going to have a city, we're going to have a place that's going to look very, very different than the way it does now. And nobody would hear that information and go, oh, what holy enlightenment have you got, you man or woman of God? You would say, oh, yeah, it makes sense. If we continue on this path, this is where this path takes us. This is why it's important. Because we're going to look at the prophets, we're going to look at what they're saying about whole nations and city, but there's also massive implications for you. And if we walk into that place of hearing the voice of the prophets and what they're saying about nations, but what it can also mean about us and our lives here and now, and we walk in ready to reject or defend, like it's a parent-teacher conference, we can't receive the word of freedom that's there for us. Prophets don't speak their message to imprison people through fear and manipulation. They speak their words to give freedom to individuals and societies and groups of people. So if we can step in to say, my identity is not at stake based on whatever is said, no matter how much it stings, I'm okay. Then I can receive it, and there's greater levels of freedom than you are experiencing right now. And we're gonna talk about all this and how this is what God has for us, okay? I hope you're excited, because it doesn't get much better than this, like in church and the Bible. So, I mean, and I want to teach you a word. The other thing, when we go through these prophecies, and you think about parent-teacher conferences, because of my abhorrent behavior, I didn't like being there for my conferences. But if I could have been there for someone else's conference, and I knew that they were a similar soul to me, and they were like a little turd, that would have been so much fun. I love listening to other people get in trouble, because it takes that big spotlight off of me. I don't want necessarily others to suffer, but I enjoy it a little bit because no one's talking about me and my things. And the Germans are so brilliant, they created a word for this. It's the Schadenfreude. Did I do it all right, Hannah? Ish. I did better in the lobby. Ah, I promise I won't shame cycle right now, but I'm not feeling good. Okay. Schadenfreude. Pleasure derived from someone else's misfortune. And there's so many times where you see these kinds of things. Now, I know we're in the Pacific Northwest. I ask for grace for this. I grew up as a 49er fan. And recently, the Seahawks have been very, very mean to me and my team. I know this isn't a popular subject. When the Seahawks lost the Super Bowl and they were on the 1 yard line, there's an image from the sideline of Richard Sherman, like all excited, we're gonna win, we're gonna score. And then he sees the interception and he goes, oh! I love that gif. I bathe in that image, you know? And it's not good. I'm not calling it good, but let's just identify how good it feels to watch someone who has made my team suffer so much suffer himself. It feels amazing, amazing. No, I can't, not now. I accept your words of freedom later. Here's why that's important. That is the book of Isaiah. Isaiah has prophecies for all kinds of different people and regions and countries. And there's parts of it that, like, he's an equal opportunity truth teller. There's parts of it where you don't want to hear it, but you don't walk away because you're like, oh, we're moving on to someone else? Let's turn up the volume. I would like to hear this. The destruction of someone else, this sounds great. And we're going to talk about this because that's the mindset, but that's actually not the role of the prophet. If the best we can make prophets is they just tell everyone they're garbage, what is the Bible and what is the gospel and who is the God that's calling these people to speak? The best we can come up with is everybody's bad? No. God is calling the prophets to address areas of corruption where they've gone aside and where they've created prisons that they think for themselves, they think have created freedom. And there's this sense of liberation. You don't have to live this way. You don't have to live this way. So if you sense in yourself like leaning into others' misfortune and their doom and like gaining pleasure from this, I think it's because we've linked this idea of who God is and what God's word for us into something that is not in the very nature of God at all. And this is, I know we're rabbit trailing a little bit, but I just can't stop. God, if we just think of the very nature of God, an all-powerful, life-generating being, that God who would create everybody to torture them, to make them feel bad about themselves, when we just went through the prayer and like how God and God's angels continue to say, don't be afraid. If you feel fear when you're in the presence of God, I would say, I don't know that you're in the presence of God. God did not create you to feel fear, to feel shame, to feel anxiety in the presence of God. It's possible that you are sitting in the presence of a God you've created because of how people have treated you and how people have engaged you. And we're going to talk about the difference between the correction of people and the correction of God. But it's quite possible you're not in the presence of God. The presence of God has come to bring you freedom, to bring you liberation. How can we receive that, and how can we celebrate that in one another? The thriving of all people, not the equal suffering of all people. Okay? Whew. Felt good for me. I hope you were okay. All right, let's do Isaiah 19, all right? We are looking at Isaiah 19, and this is a specific prophecy against Egypt. Now, just a little kind of brief history. Within the Bible, it starts, you know, Adam and Eve, and we kind of go through some different folks. It's all there, I promise. But then God calls out Abraham, and through Abraham, he starts this nation. And it goes through their sons. We kind of track a path. They multiply after the time of Joseph, and Joseph and his family, all of his brothers, they come over to Egypt. And when they start multiplying in Egypt, what happens? The Pharaoh's like, there's a whole bunch of those Israelite people. That's terrifying. They might start outnumbering us. Let's enslave them. So the Pharaoh enslaves all the Israelite people, and then comes Moses, aka Charlton Heston, to say, let my people go. So in the Israelite story, the Egyptians are not like the great ones. They are the archetype for the occupiers, the oppressors, the ones who have enslaved them and been over them, okay? So when we read about suffering for Egypt, for all Israelites of this time, it's like, that's an old enemy. I have like nostalgia glee about their downfall, right? So there's like this thing of who the Egyptians have been in that culture and in that time. In Isaiah 19, 4 through 6, it says, I will hand the Egyptians over to the power of a cruel master, and a fierce king will rule over them, declares the Lord Almighty. The waters of the river will dry up, and the riverbed will be parched and dry. The canals will stink. The streams of Egypt will dwindle and dry up. The reeds and rushes will wither. So a couple of different things here. If we talked about how the Israelites exist in Isaiah, they're in this kind of northern kingdom, and they are pawns in the much bigger game being played between Egyptians, Babylonians, and the Assyrians. These are the big power players. These are the ones that have the military might. And if you wanted to rule any part of this world at this time, it was the biggest military one. If you defeated everyone else. So the Israelites aren't playing a war game because they can't. They can't compete at that level. They're playing a political pawn game, which is, who are we going to align with? Who are we going to pick to be the one that will help us out? And what's interesting about that is for the people of God, it's like you're playing a no-win game and a bad structure and a bad system that won't take you anywhere. Finding the military with the biggest power will never actually bring you safety. There's a kind of other safety that God is calling and inviting people to. Now, you might just think we're talking about nations and all that, and we certainly are, but think about it for your life. Don't we too have this belief that if I align myself with powerful people, if I have a big enough house, I mean, even if the economy crashes, we could still sell here. I mean, we could always move to New Mexico. I've scouted on Zillow. I've seen the housing prices there. It's very cheap. There's always this idea that if I align myself with certain power, I can provide myself with a kind of safety, a certain comfort. And this manifests itself in all different kinds of ways, and who my friends are and what kind of job I have and what kind of house I live in and what kind of car I drive. I don't mean for status. I mean for protection and long-term security. And what the prophet Isaiah is saying is, like, it just doesn't take you anywhere. That doesn't end up going anywhere. And as we go through this, what would be terrifying for the Israelite hearers of this time is some of them were like, let's just align with Egypt. Like, we'll just laugh about that whole slavery thing a couple generations ago, and we'll say, like, hey, what do you need? We will align with you. And what the prophecy says, it's no better for them. Now, this is what's key here. When you hear about the Nile, and we're like, the Nile will dry up. Sometimes, because we live here, we can hear that like the Willamette River will dry up. And we're like, aw, it means some people won't be able to do stand-up paddleboarding. It's a super big bummer. Or you're like, a little dirty, I'm good. Like, I'm fine with it drying up a little bit. In the ancient world, the Nile drying up wasn't a restriction on activity. It was life itself. This would be like saying to the United States of America, your markets will crash. The stock markets will plummet. Any investments and any money you put in the bank will be so devalued on the global scale, your money will be worthless. You will have nothing. Because at this time, the Egyptians' power was firmly linked to the Nile River and how they used through incredible irrigation to support all of their crops. If the Nile dries up, they've lost the one thing that they have that separates them from the people that live out in the desert and the wilderness, of which not a lot of people live in the desert and the wilderness, right? There's a couple of nomadic tribes. Most people gather by water, and the water dries up, you die. And the reason why I say that is we're so divorced from that understanding of water and life and all that. We're like, we have to put it in different terms to understand how fear-inducing this is. We're like, Willamette dries up, I don't know, we'll make the news and I can talk to people. But like, if the markets crash, if, you know, if you, there are huge layoffs all throughout because people can't hold jobs anymore. If we just go back not that far ago, I know because my wife was in education, so many people were talking about their seniority within the school districts. I don't know, I was just hired in the last couple of years. I might be a part of this next round. That's the kind of anxiety that these images and ideas are inducing. Now, here's why we talk about all this. Are you aware of the country that we live in today? The old United States of America. Now, I'm just 36 years old, and some of you have been around longer. But here's what's interesting about the history of the United States of America. 1776 and earlier, like kind of the foundation of the United States of America until now, 2017, do you know how much global insecurity and instability we have had? How many times have you, if you grew up in America, have ever thought, should we align with Mexico or Canada? I don't know. Who's better served to keep us safe? Usually the worst kind of anxiety or thing that we feel on a national level is, it's a little embarrassing sometimes to say I'm American when I travel abroad because sometimes American tourists can be a little loud and annoying. Or sometimes they're like, you're the Homer Simpson people, right? I'm like, no, that's not us. But it doesn't get to a level of insecurity and instability that I think we do experience on a personal level, on an individual level, even though the larger system is one that doesn't cause us to ask these questions. There are times in your life where you've thought, what kind of job do I go into? What job field creates the greatest level of security? Like, do I pick this job or do I pick this career? And then even within that area, well, do I go work in this place or this business, this operation, this corporation, or do I go work here? Like, what's the more stable choice? There's this alignment where we feel a sense of powerlessness. How do I negotiate this reality? How do I find a partner in life? Do I find a partner in life? Will people judge me if I'm single for a long period of time? Or will people judge me if I'm in this relationship or that relationship? Or what church do I go to? Or what school do I go to? Or what city do I live in? There's all these places where there's these bigger existence and powers, and we don't even realize sometimes how we've linked our identity to those places until they fail, until they're not there anymore, and then this thing starts to show itself that we put a lot of our hope in that place. Here's why I say all that. We can read that and be like, serious, silly Israelites choosing between Egypt and Babylon. It's not particularly interesting. Actually not super impactful into your life and your reality that you live. The point of the Bible story is humans' interaction with God. It's your story. It's my story. I learned this dynamic, and we'll kind of walk through it quickly. I worked at youth camps for a while, and then I led mission trips. When you lead mission trips, they're like short-term mission trips internationally or abroad. They're fascinating little things. Because it's a group of people for one period of time doing one thing very intensely, usually all together, for a very short period of time. Or if you ever go to like a summer camp, or you're like, and you have a cabin, or you went to outdoor school, you had this little tribe, you had this little family that you were a part of for a very short period of time. And so some of the training that I got that was really helpful is that there's this four-step process, and people in groups can get stuck in any one of them. But it's called forming, storming, norming, and performing. And they all end in ing. They have that like kind of thing. It's helpful. You can remember it. And this is what it is. There's a link here, I promise. Forming is understanding when you find out, all right, this is the group that's going to Mexico. This is the group that's going to Africa. Or at your place of work, this is the group that's going to handle this project. This is the cabin that's going to do that. There's this kind of this introduction stage. Even if you've known each other before, it's like, okay, who's going? Who's on this team? What group is this? And usually, not always, it's kind of marked with a sense of optimism. Like, hey, everybody, let's get together. We're a team. This will be fun. And there's usually someone in the group that's like, I don't know. I'm not so sure. But someone's leading forward with like great optimism. Like, this is going to be great. But then at some point you step into storming. And sadly, some groups never break out of storming. Storming is identity confusion. Anytime you set apart a group for a short period of time, everyone walks into that group with previous identities and things that this is what I do well and this is what I don't do well. And what's interesting when you start a new group is, let's say it's a cabin at summer camp when you were a kid. Like, I'm the class clown, I'm the funny one. You walk in, you're like, who's that? What do you mean you're the class clown? I'm the class clown. That's my role. That's who I am. I'm the kid who does this. I'm the one that like packed everything. I'm the person that does this. On mission trips, we would see like, I'm the person that translates. I'm the person that is like very, I look out for everyone else in the group. I'm like the den leader, and like I have packed everyone's medications, and like I had all the preparations. And if someone's like, does anyone have Tylenol? Like my hand goes up first. That's me. Or we have, I'm the person that's going to work harder than anyone else, or I'm the person that's going to do fill in the blank. And what happens in storming is you find out that either the group doesn't need that particular skill in the way you hoped, or there's somebody else who does it too, and it causes conflict. Now, conflict isn't just yelling and fighting. Conflict can be one person withdrawing and pulling themselves out of the group because they don't feel like they fit and have a role anymore. At some point, hopefully, groups will then come into norming, and then you find out what's the new norm within this group and in this system. Who am I and how do I operate? And then ultimately, you can get into performing where you can go and you can have your roles and you can do your thing. So you see this in all different, hopefully you guys are identifying, like at work and your family, this happens massively in family dynamics. If some of you are the youngest like me, there's a storming that happens in the family system when you come back and you're still the youngest, but you are a full grown woman or man. And everyone's still like, well, looking out for you like you're five and you're like, there's a little storming going on. They're like, I'm not a child anymore, right? So it's not just one time when you do it. It can have seasons where it goes over and again. Why does all this matter? And what does it have to do with Isaiah? Great questions you hypothetically asked. The answer is when stuff changes around us, it creates identity confusion. Who am I? And the question we're really asking, we're saying, who am I and can I do here or can I be here, is do I belong? Am I okay? And a lot of us are consumed either at the front of our mind or in the back of our head with this constant loop of, do I belong? Am I okay? Do I belong? Am I okay? And some of us respond to that by hiding, so we're never exposed that we don't belong. Some of us respond by being way big and taking up all the room, and like, if I'm big and I have enough opinions, then everyone will say, well, clearly I belong. We all respond differently, but anytime there's transition in your life, we're asking these questions. And in Isaiah, there's massive geopolitical transitions going on and massive transitions going on with the nation of Israel. And what the questions that they're asking and why the prophets are speaking into is, who are we? What is this people? What's our role now? We used to be God's chosen people. We used to be the people that when David and Solomon, we were the people that had the big, beautiful temple. That's who we were. If we don't have that temple anymore, then who are we? And it creates this big storm in the midst of them all. So this is what's beautiful. We're going to look as they continue in Isaiah 19. Isaiah creates the picture of this is who you are. 19, 23, and 25. In that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. Just to pause there, a highway, like a thoroughfare between Egypt and Assyria, no Israelite is looking forward to that. That's a war zone. That's not a highway. That's a DMZ. That's the place where all the battles happen. So the fact that there is free and easy commerce, people are moving back and forth between those two places, is already a mind-blowing thought. There will be a highway from Egypt to Assyrians. The Assyrians will go to Egypt and the Egyptians to Assyria. The Egyptians and Assyrians will worship together. Another stop. We'll worship together? No. That's not how the Assyrians and the Egyptians operated. The Egyptians had their gods, which maybe a more helpful current way of thinking about this is, we'll think about football. The Seahawks versus the 49ers. We don't come together and worship the Eagles. That's insanity. I worship the Seahawks, my team. You worship your 49er, your team, and then we do battle to find out who's the best. Worship together, it doesn't work that way. The whole system is set up to be antagonistic and violent against one another. For them to be worshiping together, something big has happened to change everything. And again, this is what the prophet's saying. It's happening. This big thing is coming. In that day, Israel will be third along with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing on the earth. The Lord Almighty will bless them, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance. Oh, that line. I just talked about how Egypt had their god that they worshipped, and that god's only role was to empower them to beat the Assyrians. The Assyrians had their god that they worshipped, and that god's role was to empower them so they could defeat the Egyptians, and the Israelites were just picking between the two. What do you mean we're all on the same team now? And we're waiting to see who's the bad and who's going to win this battle. What do you mean these people are my people? God said the Egyptians are God's own people. No, God, I think you're confused about the nature of how worshiping gods work. We called dibs on you, our God. We've already identified you as the God of Abraham and Isaac, and you're going to protect us during this time and ultimately lead us to victory over either the Assyrians or the Egyptians. That's how this works. And what's beautiful is the prophet is saying, you've reduced God to something far too small. You've reduced God to a logo you put on your football helmets and your flags and the turf that you play on. And you're calling it this kind of tribalistic, nationalistic, this is our God. And God's saying, I am far too big for that. I am their God too. And then at first you could say, I'm the God of the Egyptians. And they're like, whew. Now we know who to align with. It's clearly the Egyptians, because God is their God too. Whoa, 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 whoa. It continues and says, Assyria is my handiwork? The Assyrians? We're pretty sure that these are people bred from dogs. They're not even human. There's this dehumanizing language and understanding, and what do you mean you're their God too? It breaks and shatters all of this. This thing where then you could sit alongside and say, tell me more about their destruction. Hey, prophet, I know you're going. Can we pause for a second and go back to the Nile River drying up? I don't know why. That made me feel really good inside. It like sparked a little something. The thing, the doom, the gloom, that this is not going well, it isn't so God can punish everyone who's messed up. God is saying, because in God's love, there is freedom to choose other than God. God doesn't demonstrate his love through control. He demonstrates it through freedom. There's freedom to choose other ways, and that has consequences. But what has always been and will always be the plan? One nation, one people. Where you don't get to look at someone else and say they are other, because that category doesn't exist in God's framework. God has continued to say, I am one God, the God that breaks all this tribal understanding of God. And what do we do with that? Constantly, Christians and people of faith say, yes, one God, our God, the God that we have over here, the God that we have correctly understood, and we have this God who will defeat all of your gods. And God's like slapping her hand, stop, please stop doing that. No, the God of all people in all places. And we're like, yes, you're the God of all people, but they don't recognize you as such. And until we defeat them and prove to them through the military might or through the power that you will give us, they're never really going to learn that you're their God too. And God keeps on saying, too small. It's bigger than that. The blessing of the God who is bigger than that, the significance of the God who is bigger than that, is when we're going through these storming periods of life, where the circumstances in our lives are changing, we're figuring out, who do I align with? How do I mark my life through relationships, through vocation, through fill in the blank, through religious affiliation? That God is there to say, I am your God, and I'm a God of this people, of all people. To keep on investing in the right path is to assume that there is a wrong path and there is a wrong people and there is a wrong choice, because you are going to understand or you're going to find success or thriving through your right choice of this thing down here. And God's saying, it's bigger than that. So we stop asking questions about what's the right team to align with, and we say, how can we see thriving of all teams, of all people, of all countries? This requires us on the deepest level to listen to the stories of others and not pass judgment on, that doesn't make sense from my experience. Well, here's the good news. It's their God too. And they have their story, and we hear it and we receive it as their story, and we see it's bigger than that. If we're launching wars, we're missing the heart of God and where this whole thing is going. Now, I said I would talk about correction and repentance, and this is the part. I am a person who fulfills my word. Let's talk about correction of people versus the correction of God. How many of you have ever been on like a road trip? Like maybe you've been in like the back of the car, something like that. If you had siblings or an active imagination, and you would start arguments with just yourself, at some point along the drive, it's a fairly common experience where your parent who is driving will lean back and say something to stop it. Stop doing this thing. I will pull this car over. I will turn this car around. I will do something. Something about your behavior is not working in this car right now, and you need to fix it so we can continue this trip and be happy, right? We're not getting to Disneyland until you be quiet. That kind of correction, we're used to this kind of correction. This correction is not always, but often based out of control. How can I get you Or how can I control your behavior so that I'm more comfortable? So that I feel better. Oftentimes, if you have performance reviews, sometimes your supervisor is there because they're really interested in you thriving in your workspace. More often than not, because of how the systems are set up, they're interested in protecting their own reputation. So the corrections they bring to you are not for your freedom, they're for their greater levels of control. This is usually how human beings, this is how people bring correction. Hey, I just want to tell you you're doing this thing, and it's embarrassing us. Can you stop that? Hey, you're doing this thing, it's really uncomfortable for me. Can you stop that? Very rarely do we see another person who's doing something where like they're harming themselves by doing this behavior. How can I help them find freedom where like they don't have to do that thing, they don't have to live in that space? Most of our correction to one another is how do I stop feeling uncomfortable about your actions and your things? The hardest thing for me personally as a parent of young kids is how am I not bringing correction to my kids? Almost all of it's about me. It's not about my kids. And there is something good within that in saying, hey, we're a family, we're a community here, and like the screaming hurts my ears. But usually we're not having that conversation. We're having, stop it, stop it. You have to stop. You're yelling, you're always yelling. Can you stop yelling for a little bit? Because I'm trying to control this behavior that I don't like. And oftentimes we take that understanding of correction and we extend it to God. That God is calling us to correction, that the prophets are coming and saying there's a path, there's a way, there's a direction you're moving in your life, and God is bringing that correction, not for our freedom, not for our benefit, but to control us in some way. And when we feel like people are bringing corrective suggestions or word to us from a place of control, many of us put up all of our walls immediately. You know, I wouldn't yell all the time if you would play with me. I wouldn't have to run around the house if, you know, like if you'd come in and like play Legos with me from a child's perspective. If you're an adult, I wouldn't have to have these conversations with you at work about, you know, doing these different things if you would just tell me as my supervisor what you want me to do. And we have this thing where there's good to have feedback and dialogue, but usually we're not able to hear it and receive it because we don't trust the information is coming from a good place. We're certain it's about controlling us. So we're immediately resistant. And here's why that matters. Most of us devote a ton of energy to hiding from others and from ourselves. Most of us, a lot of us, I don't know about that, me, I'm sure of me, I devote a lot of energy to like, I want you all right now to think I'm okay. I want you to recognize how little I've looked at my notes. It's all up here. I want you to see me in a particular way, not for your benefit, but because I'm terrified that if you really sat with me and you really got to know me, you'd find out like, oh, he's not, doesn't know as much as I thought he did. I thought he had this thing. I thought he was like a good pastor, but that was just at a distance. And when I convince myself of that story and of that loop, I create more distance and I'm more scared of having authentic interactions and conversations. Because I feel like the only place letting people close can result in is them trying to control me by correcting my behavior or exposing the ways that I am a failure and I don't belong. What if we heard voices of correction internally and externally as just information? We said, I'm just going to sit with this thing. Kurt, you're not very good at showing up at meetings on time. Yes. Mm-hmm. I see that. I'm just going to sit with that thing. Everything within me are like, but you don't know my life and my story. And there was the traffic and the thing. And well, I tried to get out of the house on time, but there was really this thing. And then Porter vomited everywhere. And like, there's all these things where I'm hearing something about myself I may not want to see or sit with. So I'm going to put out like, but this, and this. If I give you enough information, we can talk about something else. What if I can just sit with it and sit with myself and say, it's okay. I think that's what the prophet, I think this is what God is calling us to do. There's this thing you need to see, and if you're so defensive about it and you're so reactive to it and you're telling everybody all the reasons why it's there and you can't just sit with it, then you're not going to find freedom. Those walls you put up to keep others out work. And we feel isolated and we feel alone. And sometimes we put ourselves on the other side of those walls. We don't even know who we are anymore. God did not create us to be strangers to ourselves. God created us to be able to sit with who we are and say, you're with me. This is okay. This correction isn't for control. The correction that comes from God is for freedom. So much of my life was believing this book, this document, this understanding of Christianity was, I wouldn't put the words to it, was ultimately about controlling my behavior. And if we just get a big group of people to stop doing all the fun things, then we can have this great Christian movement. Instead of saying, there's actually an imprisonment that comes on the other side of these ways that we hurt each other and we hurt ourselves. The things we call sins, the lying, the gossip, the misdirection, the blaming, the shame that we turn upon ourselves, these all create prisons and they create something that God didn't make us for. God created us to be free. The first step to freedom is getting uncomfortable. I'm going to sit with the word and I'm going to just let it be. Because if we're not there, then we cringe and we hide from all the things we think are about us. And then we're like, okay, let's talk about some other people, huh? I mean, Tim in accounting's a jerk, am I right? No. Let's just sit and say, this too is okay. So this is the next step. When we talk about prophets, when we talk about Isaiah, when we talk about these words from God, can we trust that the words that are calling us are an invitation to freedom, not God trying to control us? And can we sit with our inadequacies? And just this thing is there. I've heard people say this about me. And I'm not going to just receive it in and be like, well, it must be true. This is not, no. But we sit with it and just in the same room and say, is this true? Is this me? Is this in me? Because usually those things, especially as God brings this, they are methods and tools for imprisonment, self-imprisonment. They're not serving you. They're not helping you. Maybe they kept you safe for a while. They're not keeping you safe anymore. They're isolating you. They're hurting you. They're putting you somewhere else other than what God created us for. God comes to bring freedom. I'm going to go back to the thing that I said before. If the presence of God, if the presence in church fills you with fear and fills you with a sense of judgment and shame, these are not the characteristics that we ever see reflected of God. And so I would say, what are we sitting in the presence of if that's what we're feeling? Because God has said, don't be afraid. You're okay. You can sit with these things and we can move forward.